Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A 2011 World Bank report described an enormous growth in demand for foreign land. Countries like Ethiopia, Mozambique, Sudan, for example, selling millions of acres of their land to foreign governments and to corporations and to wealthy individuals. What's driving this? Is this neocolonialism? Does this have implications for the rising cost of food, maybe food shortages around the world? Huge tracts of land in many developing countries being sold to other countries and to corporations. Our next guest, London-based environmental journalist Fred Pierce, he was with The Guardian, went out to meet the buyers, and he describes them in his new book, The Land Grabbers. Fred, welcome back to our show.
Hi, good to talk to you.
What is land grabbing, and are rising food prices the main issue here?
Rising food prices is what started it, and concern about food supplies after that big panic about food back in 2008 after a couple of droughts and biofuels and that kind of thing. Everybody suddenly got worried about whether they could supply their own food, or at least developing world countries. On top of that, there's a lot of speculation going on. I found an awful lot of people in the City of London, in Wall Street. Pension funds, probably your pension fund money is going into this kind of thing. A lot of people thinking land is the next big thing. George Soros was widely quoted in about 2009 saying land was just about the best investment around now. And where George Soros goes, a great financier, quite a lot of people follow. So it's the big new thing among financiers who, despite the recession and everything, still have quite a lot of cash in their back pockets.
Africa is the site of many of these purchases, especially in something known as the Guinea Savannah Zone. What is that and why there?
Guinea Savannah Zone, it's the grasslands. It's the classic African savannah lands, which used to be full of wildlife, and some of it still is. The bits between the rainforests and the desert, basically, that's an awful lot of Africa. There's about 20-odd countries in it. And most of it's still unfenced. Cattle pasture land. Some of it's still got wildlife in it. Some of it people do shifting cultivation, that kind of stuff, farmers moving around. It's land that isn't very tightly owned. Basically, it's owned by the state rather than individuals. So it's up for sale, much of it, or up for lease. The World Bank identified that area as the last large open land in the world available for farmers, available for people who want to invest in land. And that's exactly what's going on here. And a lot of African governments are quite keen to hand this land over to foreign investors, partly, I think, because they're feeling rather guilty about having not invested in their own agriculture for several decades now. That's why African farming is in such a bad state. So they think that foreign investors can kind of do the trick for them. It can be a kind of quick fix for agriculture. I think that's profoundly mistaken. I think they should be investing in their own farmers, in their smallholders, and in their pastoralists, not handing over land to foreign investors.
Let's take an example. You write about the activities of a company called Saudi Star in Ethiopia. How did they become interested in buying agricultural land there?
Well, the boss of Saudi Star is a big mate of the prime minister there. He's a Saudi as well as an Ethiopian, so he has a number of loyalties. And he's taken over a lot of land, 100,000 hectares, so a quarter of a million acres, in a district called Gambela in southwest Ethiopia. It's pretty much as remote as you can get. It's near the border with South Sudan, really in the backwoods of Africa. And as I say, he's got a lot of land at really a peppercorn rent, and there's an Indian investor there called Karaturi doing much the same thing. They're taking over huge areas of this land, and the people are being moved off their land. And I met a guy, my purpose of this book was not just talk to the investors, but to talk to the people on the land that they're taking. And I met a guy called Omot, who'd been living in his forest clearing, doing fishing and hunting and a little bit of farming for Well, his family had been doing it for 10 generations, he told me, and they probably go back further than that. And they'd just been moved off the land. They were just being told, sorry, you've got to go. And I sat in by his hut, and literally 20 yards away, there were trucks going up and down the road, clearing land, digging a canal. He was just going to have to move out. Nobody told him where he'd got to go, but he was just going to have to move. And I met lots of people like this around the world who, even though governments talk about the investment being to promote development of the land, so far as I could see, it was depriving people of livelihoods and not really giving them anything in return.
Fred Pierce, environmental journalist, author of the new book, The Land Grabbers. Are there any examples, according to you, of good land grabs? You know, people say foreign direct investment in a country is often a good thing, better than government-to-government aid, just relief. Is there economic growth that is happening in some places because of these purchases?
If it's done right, yes, I believe it can. I certainly agree that we should be trading and investing and dealing with Africa rather than sort of regarding the whole continent as a basket case only fit for our aid. We've got to help them. The question is how. I saw palm oil plantations. Palm oil plantations are suddenly getting quite big in Africa. They're moving out of Southeast Asia and into Africa. And I saw a couple of them. I saw some bad ones, but I saw at least one good one where they were providing jobs for locals. Perhaps very important, they were buying palm oil from local farmers, so encouraging them to cultivate their own land and then buying and processing the material. And they were building schools, and they were improving the roads, and they were putting in clinics and doing a lot of good things. So they were investing in the community and doing something good. But what I found too often was people who just had a kind of get-rich-quick mentality. They just wanted to get in and out of Africa, make some money as fast as they could. They didn't really trust the local people or the local government or anything to deliver anything permanent in ways of improvement there. They just wanted to get in and out and make some cash. And this, you know, there's too much of that short-termism. This is not particular to land grabbers. In general, I think investors are too keen to just take a quick bit of cash and move out rather than thinking about the long term. So yes, there is good to it. There is good investment. The problem was I just saw an awful lot too much of the bad stuff.
Is China a big player?
Surprisingly small, actually, in Africa especially. It's big in Southeast Asia. There are an awful lot of rubber plantations in Laos and Vietnam and so on. And through Southeast Asia, it's their own backyard, really. You know, it's Uncle Who's backyard, and they're really quite busy there. But in Africa, yes, of course, they're very big in minerals there. They're buying up mines everywhere and for their industrialization. But they're not buying up much in the way of land. I think they find it a little difficult working with African farmers. Their ways of just kind of cultures are very different. So the Chinese, so far at any rate, have been quite cautious. So while we read quite a lot in the media about Chinese in Africa, on agriculture, they're less of a player than you would imagine. I mean, there is less going on there, less investors from China than probably from Wall Street.
You also write about green land grabbing. What's that?
Yeah, this gets me into trouble with environmentalists, I have to say, but I do really have problems with environmentalists who just move in and take the land off people in ways which are really very similar to some of the more cynical corporate land grabbers. Now, they're doing it in the name of, you know, good thing. They're trying to save species and save ecosystems and so on, so you can understand why they're doing it, and most of them don't have you know, bad motives. But some of the consequences are really quite bad, and a lot of local people get very angry with environmentalists who set up a national park or take over some grasslands and restrict, say, people's ability to graze. You get quite a lot of conflicts where cattle grazers are being moved off land to make way for wildlife. And I find that a little strange because the locals, by and large, they and their cattle got on very well with wildlife over thousands of years. That's why the wildlife is still there. And yet many kind of Western environmentalists tend to think they know better and they want to move in and they want to take over and manage the land in their way and create what you'd say were like the sort of parks that there are in Europe or particularly in North America, sort of pristine national parks where nobody else does anything with the land except go around with cameras and be a tourist. And I don't think that works in Africa because you're taking land off people people that use the land and still know how to use the land. Worst, perhaps, of all, environmentalists land up being enemies of the local custodians, as I would put it, of the land. And I think that's bad news all round. You know, if you as environmentalists and sort of progressives in general, we ought to be making friends with the locals, not making enemies.
Environmental journalist Fred Pierce, author of a new book called The Land Grabbers. And you say that over the next few decades, you believe land grabbing could affect more people than climate change. That's quite a statement. How come?
It depends how far out we go. I mean, climate change is obviously a big issue. I've written a lot about climate change. I think it's a really serious issue. But what I think is that actually right now, land grabbing is affecting more poor people, particularly in Africa, than climate change is. It's just affecting more lives. It's damaging more lives. It's doing more damage to people and their futures. It's depriving them of land. We talk about refugees from climate change, and yes, there are some of those around because of droughts and floods and so on. But there are a lot more refugees from land grabs turning up in the shanty towns of the megacities of Africa than there are refugees from climate change. That could alter, but it seems to me that we're kind of in it's the last kind of roundup of untamed lands in Africa going on here. It's the last. We in Europe talk about the enclosure movement when people, a couple of hundred years ago now, started fencing off the common lands. And that's really what's going on in Africa in the Guinea Savannah zone now. The common lands, the collectively owned lands, the pasture lands, the forest lands are being fenced, they're being tamed, they're being owned. And right now, I don't think that's good for Africa. I don't really think it's good for the planet either.
Let me take a phone call for you, 212-433-WNYC. Wale in South Amboy. Wale, thanks for calling again. Hello.
Hello. Okay, hi. Mr. Pierce, very good thing you're doing. I feel very strongly about this. I personally consider it as another round of colonization of Africa specifically. But you know what?
Yes, I think
it's going on right now. So one thing that I would suggest, having not read your book, is that it would be good if you and others will publicize and advocate that these lands be treated the same way people would treat lands here. If you look at the oil industry, people go to African countries and elsewhere and engage in practices that could not be done over here. So you end up with areas like Niger Delta of Nigeria, where rivers are polluted, there is oil on the land, something that you could not even do or attempt over here. Now they're going to go out there, open up large tracts of land, and watch erosion wash these soils away. And once they're unproductive, they're going to be abandoned, and the foreigners are going to take off, and the local people are going to end up with land that's unproductive.
Yeah, I think much of what you say is right. I think a lot of what's needed is actually application of the law. People need to be able to establish their rights to the land so that their land can't be taken away. In most of Africa today, most of the land is kind of legally owned by the state. There may be some competing communal claims, customary land rights, as they say there. But I think those common land rights, those customary land rights, if they were enshrined properly in law, and there are campaigns to do this, then it would allow people to assert their rights, to say, no, this is our land, you can't come into our land. So, maybe we need a few more lawyers on this case to do something about it. But I really do agree that we can't leave the land just as sort of open and under no ownership. What I do think is that we have to assert the right of communities of cattle herders and farmers and forest dwellers and so on to control their own land. After all, you know, this has been their land for thousands of years. Why should it not carry on being their own land?
Wally, thank you so much for your call. We're almost out of time, but I wonder, and since climate change came up in the context of your new book, if I could go back a few years for something else that you had done that was prominent that some of our listeners may not know about and kind of take your temperature on it today, because you reviewed the ClimateGate so-called emails from the International Panel on Climate Change in an investigation for The Guardian, and you defended their conclusions, but you were somewhat critical of the scientific community's process. Has that affected the way you approach environmental journalism today, or has it changed your view of the seriousness of climate change?
It's not changed my view of the seriousness of climate change. What I do think is that some of the scientists have rather oversold what we know for sure. So the climate skeptics, as we call them, maybe were right on to say that, you know, all those lines on the graphs that the climate scientists do predicting climate future, well, we really don't know that for certain. There are the error bars or whatever are just huge on those things. I think the skeptics were right to point that out, but I don't think they're then right to say, well, we don't have to worry about climate change because, you know, we could be underestimating as much as overestimating. So, yes, I have been rather critical about the scientists and some of their kind of processes and procedures and their kind of reluctance to engage in debate with their skeptics, but I don't think they're frauds, and I don't think they're wrong to want to research these issues. I just think we just have to be a little more adult about accepting that we don't know all the answers on climate change, but it remains a scary topic for me.
Fred Pierce, environmental journalist. His new book is The Land Grabbers. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up next, 8th grade girls from New Jersey win a national video game design competition. We'll ask two of them, how do you make technology classes gender neutral? Stay with us.